Welcome, Karis families, to the Karis Podcast. This is Katie Tuck, and I'm here with
Austin Hoffman.
Hey, Austin is the assistant headmaster at Karis, and he also teaches our rhetoric classes and logic classes. He's teaching Huma and Latin this year, and we are going to talk about Macbeth. One of your Huma classes, is it more than one Huma class is going through Macbeth right now?
Yeah, so just the one class is doing Macbeth right now. The other class is just wrapping up Oedipus Rex.
Okay, so we're gonna go over Macbeth and not Oedipus Rex today. So you had a wonderful article in Forma this summer, which is a publication with the Circe Institute, correct?
Yep. So
Forma is a wonderful magazine that comes out 4 times a year.
Used to be 4 times. I think they just dropped down to 2 times a year.
Okay. Okay. Well, the summer issue was wonderful. Your article was on Macbeth called Masks and Mirrors, and I loved it. I had you sign it for me. So if you can get any copies of it, go out and get it. But will you talk a little bit about writing that article before? I know you knew that you were going to be teaching on Macbeth this year. So will you talk about maybe the relationship between those two things?
Yeah, so I guess my experience with Macbeth, I can't remember if I was exposed to it before teaching at Karis, but I did teach the play for the first time, I guess it was 6 years ago now, to our first 7th grade class, and this is the 3rd time teaching it. In between those times, I've read it a number of times and really enjoyed the play, probably one of my favorite Shakespeare plays. I think the inspiration behind the article and getting into that was there's a French philosopher by the name of René Girard who has this whole theory of mimetic envy and how people can come into conflict with each other, not because they're different, but because they actually want the same thing. They not only want the same thing, but they want it precisely because their best friend wants it. Hmm. Right. So, you know, two people perhaps because they're so similar, end up wanting the same job or the same position and, you know, and so on. And this brings them into conflict. And he has a great book called Theater of Envy, which is his position is basically Shakespeare knew about this theory. Shakespeare was teaching this whole theory in all of its various parts. And he goes through a number of Shakespeare plays. But one of the ones he doesn't do is Macbeth. And so I was thinking about the play, reading it with students and starting to notice a lot of the elements in the play. And so I decided to try and write some aspects of that. In the play as I was teaching and bringing that out to students.
Oh, I love it. That's great. So when you consume Macbeth, you read the play. Have you ever watched the play either live or watched it like a video of it, like Patrick Stewart performing it or anything like that?
Yeah. So with the first class I taught, I was trying to find a video edition that I could actually show to them or recommend to them. So I've watched a number of different versions. So there's an old Orson Welles version, I think like 1940, maybe.
Okay, wow.
It's a pretty old. It's black and white. It has some very gloomy, dark feel. It's lots of kind of natural rock formations, like with the castle. So it's kind of an interesting one. I did watch the Patrick Stewart one version, which is a more modernized version, kind of set in a World War II. Ish setting. There's a much more recent version, 2015, I think Michael Fassbender, and I can never pronounce her name right, but it's like Brie Corleard or something like that, I don't know. But anyways, and that's a decent version. There's some elements in it that make it difficult to show to kids, so.
That's what I hear, yeah.
Yeah,
and I've heard the Patrick Stewart one is it the Patrick Stewart one or the most recent one that has like a rap in it? Or just...
So I've never watched a version of Macbeth that has a rap in it. That I know.
Okay.
Patrick Stewart has kind of a creepy scene with the witches, which I thought would scare some of the kids. So
okay,
haven't shown that one yet.
Got it. Yeah, but do you show the older version then to your students?
I have for 2 years. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it this year because it is harder for them to connect with that version.
Sure.
And so I may just recommend a few versions and say to parents, you know, if this is something you're comfortable showing, go for it, because I think it will vary. And then, of course, it was last summer. I think I had the experience of going to see Macbeth at the Spring Green Theater with the Tucks, and that was incredible. And I think that was the first Shakespeare play I've ever seen in theater.
Hmm.
So talking about the difference between reading it and seeing it, of course, right? They're made to be performed. They're made to be seen and consumed, as you put it, in that way.
Yeah.
But I really like reading it because you can slow down and you can go back and forth and it's easier to see the language that's being used and mark things. So that's, you know, maybe a guilty confession that that's my preferred method.
Sure.
Of course, it might not be the ideal one, but I enjoy it.
I feel like it's my guilty confession that I have a hard time with Shakespeare unless I'm listening to it or watching it on stage. I think my first time really enjoying Shakespeare was years and years ago when we went to, I forgot, it was like the Chicago Shakespeare Players. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, I like this. I really enjoy this. So yeah, I think it's good. We always have the dumbed down version on the right side with the regular version on the left side while I'm reading it. So that's my question.
Well, it definitely makes it come alive and you can see how the characters are interacting. And I think that's especially hard for students to visualize sometimes is they can see the stage directions and you know, that I believe are added in by editors and things like that. But it doesn't really help them see how these different things are happening, or even the timing of delivering lines helps them to understand them better.
Like, sure.
Oh, that actually wasn't one thought that he just strung together. There's actually two different thoughts, and then he turns to somebody else and says, right?
Yeah.
So seeing it, hearing it can definitely going back reading it later.
Are there any difficult passages that you find yourself coming back to and you say, instead of reading it, let's read it out just to yourself. Let's read it out loud.
In general, I try to have them read some of it out loud in class. Like if we're reading in class, I'll try and assign different parts, try and get them to act out different scenarios. So for example, in Macbeth, as we read together the scene where Macbeth is hosting all of his thanes, all of his nobles in his castle, and then all of a sudden he sees Banquo's ghost, and trying to get them to picture, like, everybody else is watching him kind of have this mental breakdown and they can't see Banquo's ghost.
Yeah.
And seeing that interaction where he's talking to them and he seems fine and then he starts becoming quite agitated because Banquo's dead body is in his seat. But of course they don't really want to go all the way because it's not theater class, it's not acting class, so it's a little difficult there.
Sure, that makes sense. Yeah. Can you give us just a quick overview of Macbeth for people who may not have read it before?
Sure.
Or seen it?
Yeah, so it's Shakespeare's shortest play. It takes place in maybe 600 to 800-ish era Scotland. Maybe that's too early. But anyways, kind of this pre-established monarchy, pre-United Kingdom. Macbeth is a thane of Duncan, which means he's one of his lords or one of his nobles. Duncan assigns him, we'll give him gifts. Macbeth's responsibility is to fight for Duncan, defend him, go to war against his enemies. So the play opens up with Macbeth in one of these wars against another thane of Duncan who has rebelled against him, the thane of Cawdor. Mm-hmm. And Macbeth is quickly displayed as this noble, fearsome warrior who is taking on essentially two armies at the same time. And he's a great soldier for Duncan, the king, to rely on, the king of Scotland. Mm-hmm. After one of these battles, and after he's reigned in the rebellion, he and Banquo meet three witches on one of the moors or one of the plains, and they give these three statements, right? Hail, Thane of Glamis, hail, Thane of Cawdor, hail, king, or thou shalt be king hereafter. And Macbeth immediately hears this and says, well, I'm Thane of Glamis, I'm not the Thane of Cawdor, right? He's the traitor I've been fighting against, and he's still alive. And then king? What does that mean? And almost immediately after these witches disappear again, the announcement comes, you're Thane of Cawdor. So this sets Macbeth's mind in motion. Well, maybe this other one will come true. And to try and condense it down a bit, right? With the prompting of his wife, known as Lady Macbeth, he conspires to assassinate and murder Duncan in his bed while Duncan is staying as a guest in Macbeth's castle. Duncan's sons flee because they are assumed to be the guilty ones. Macbeth takes over as king of Scotland and quickly discovers that one murder isn't enough. He now has to murder Banquo, a fellow thane. He tries to murder Banquo's son, who was also promised the crown. He does actually murder the wife and child of another one of his thanes, and this just starts spiraling out of control until finally the exiled son comes back with all of those who are upset at the tyrant Macbeth, and they end up killing Macbeth in the end. And restoring the crown to Malcolm or Fleance, depending on how you want to interpret it.
Sure. Yeah, so many questions, but I'm going to ask you this one that I know is kind of usually controversial, right? Like, are the witches real or are they not real?
Yeah. So I've always assumed that they're real. I don't really have a knee-jerk reaction against the supernatural. I think sometimes whether reading history or whether reading old sources, there's kind of this knee-jerk reaction like, oh, that's fantastical or that's supernatural. So obviously somebody just made it up. Well, you know, I believe quite fully in supernatural things all the time. There's plenty in the Bible. So I don't have a knee-jerk reaction against it being real either in history or in literature. So I've always taken them as real figures who show up and set this whole thing in motion. It's certainly an interesting story with some historical basis without them. But I think it definitely changes the character of the play when the opening scene are these three witches meeting and deciding to meet Macbeth and deliver him these instructions, which really set all of the events in motion.
Yeah, for sure. So if you think of the discussions you've had in your class, either so far with Macbeth or even when you taught it before, what, 6 years ago, can you tell me if there's any similarities to how the discussions roll? Or I'm just thinking about culture. Culture's changed a little bit, right, in the last 6 years. And I'm wondering if some of those discussions in your classroom have changed as well.
Well, I think they're always different in part because I'm always approaching it from a different angle. I don't really have a pre-scripted lesson that I'm going to. All right, here are the things that you need to see in Macbeth, but it's what I'm noticing perhaps at the current reading that I'm doing with the students. There are some elements that come out, you know, frequently that I've really been drawn to. So this current reading, I've really been trying to focus on the students, this idea of appearances and how you can know who you can trust. Because Duncan, of course, says there's no art to find the mind's construction in the face. He was depending on a thane who turned it out to be traitorous, right? The Thane of Cawdor. And then immediately gives that very same title to Macbeth, who is just as traitorous as Cawdor. The witches, when they appear, they're described, Macbeth and Banquo are both confused at first at their appearances because they sound like women, but they have beards and they vanish and they don't really know what's going on. Macbeth, of course, has to disguise his intentions. And then the discussion we were having in class, I think it was just yesterday now, which would be Wednesday, was Macbeth goes back to the witches a second time to get more prophecy or instruction from them, just asking the students, right, should Macbeth be trusting them, really based on their appearances? I mean, they've told him accurate information so far, but they're boiling up this brew with, like, you know, people's body parts and animal parts and, And just bringing out the idea that there's kind of a reaction against judging by appearances, against just discriminating by people's appearances. And there's certainly wrong ways that can be done. But many times that's all we have to go on at first. But it's difficult because I can't remember if it's Macduff to Malcolm or Malcolm to Macduff, but he essentially says, right, everything that's evil has to wear the brows of grace, but that which is truly good must always be so. Is that evil has to disguise itself as good, but good still has to appear that way. So how do you know which is which? How do you know who you can trust? So we're trying to go down that trail with them. When is it wrong to judge by appearances? When is it just natural sorts of discrimination and making judgments? Right. So I'm trying to find a babysitter for my son or something, right? I'm making that judgment a lot on appearances. Like, if you appear irresponsible, I'm probably not going to trust you. You might be totally responsible. You might be perfectly fine. But if that's all I have to go on, right, I'm going to make that judgment because I have to protect my son.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good. Any aha moments with Shakespeare that you've seen in your classroom that were really encouraging or exciting or anything that you're looking for, I guess?
Yeah, it's hard to gauge sometimes with students. You know, Shakespeare has not only the difficulties with language, right? It's so far removed from our own. of course, not everybody in Elizabethan England was walking around speaking in blank verse either.
Right.
So I think for a first reading for many of them, which I think this is, I'm really satisfied if they can understand the plot of the play, if they can pull out some of the elements of it. If they were asked to meditate on some of the questions that Shakespeare's raising, you know, in this play or in another. Yeah, I'm very, very satisfied with that, even if there's no like, oh, this is the most incredible play I've ever read, and I'm going to read this every year for the rest of my life, right? Yeah. That's fairly rare for students, but yeah,
I think
if they're willing to go see a production or they're willing to return to it in 5 years or 10 years, I think that's a win.
Yeah, absolutely. How about what you would suggest for our listeners? So they're probably going to be parents of teachers younger, I'm sorry, parents of students, whether they're younger or older. If they are going to be delving into Shakespeare or want to try a play, would this be a good one to start with? Or what would you suggest, especially with younger students, if they're going to be coming up and reading Macbeth, or even ones that are you know, working on Macbeth right now?
Yeah. I think Macbeth is a good one to begin with, in that it's the shortest, I don't know if it's the shortest, but it's certainly one of the shortest.
Sure.
The plot is fairly simple and accessible. If you're of course you might want to use parental discretion if you're watching a movie or going to see a play, because there are definitely demonic ish elements of it with the witches and their activities and what they're doing and what they're saying. Those parts will probably be more difficult to understand. Of course, there's the murder, there's the bloodshed. And of course, I guess something else to point out, especially with those with younger students, is that Shakespeare's writing for multiple audiences. So he's writing for the royalty. So he's writing for James I, with Macbeth, I believe Elizabeth later on. But he's also writing for the common people, right? That just want to have a good time. And so there's a fair number of puns, innuendos, sexual jokes, all these kinds of things worked in. Mm-hmm. So depending on the edition you're reading, right? If it has all the good notes and plain English translation right next to it, you might want to be more careful with your students. A lot of times I find they fly right over their heads and they just don't get them. So it's right. You just keep moving and don't look at the notes on that page or something.
Yeah.
another one you might consider would be maybe Henry V. That's kind of a rah-rah England play. But it seems to be another good one to enter in with.
Okay.
So if you're thinking middle school, high school, I think those are great places to start.
Okay. And start with reading it, you would suggest, and not necessarily with watching it for the parent, not for the student necessarily. But.
Oh, yeah. Not necessarily. I mean, if you can find a production that you can go see, I'd absolutely recommend that. I like reading them personally, but mm-hmm. I think of course going to see the play is absolutely a great way to experience it and can bring it alive. My recommendation would just be to if you go down that route, is try and see as many different versions as you can, because each one are bringing something different to the table, emphasizing different things. So for example, I think it's the 2015 Macbeth made some really interesting decisions about, they had a scene where, I think at the beginning, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are burying one of their child. Cause a big mm-hmm. problem of the play is that they have no children. And so that just adds an element like, no, you know, they had a child, but he died either in infancy or very young. At the very end, I believe they also had Fleance come in and pick up the crown, kind of giving a nod to, right, he's going to become the king. Of course, he's a claimed ancestor of James I, who is seeing this play for the first time.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yeah. Nice. Interesting. Okay. And when you, I'm going to back up just a little bit, but when you introduce Shakespeare, do you talk about the time period? So you've just done that with us a little bit, but do you do that with your students as well? And, or do you go into more detail? How do you introduce Shakespeare?
Yeah. So the way I like to deal with kind of the historical background and some of these things that are going on is to try and introduce them as we're going through the play. I think I gave them a very, very brief, introduction and setting, We're in 1606 England. James I has just become king. He was formerly the king of Scotland, but now he just inherited the English crown as well. The year before, in 1605, actually, I think I shared this at the very beginning, there was a plot to assassinate King James, right? So immediately you're seeing this connection where this assassination of Duncan, this attempted assassination of James, he's thinking to himself, oh, this is great. This is a play about how it's wrong to kill your king. All right, so remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot, right? Mm-hmm. Those were the events of the year before. And there's actually, I think, several references to that plot throughout the play. So I'll try and bring those things like that out as we're reading the play, trying to give the historical setting. And then it also helps make some of the questions that we're talking about more poignant. Mm-hmm. Because, right, James I, of course, is watching this play, and Shakespeare has to write it in a way that you don't go against the crown, right? Because if you make the king angry, well, your theater is going to get shut down. You're not going to be able to produce anymore. James I, I believe, claimed that the king's authority is essentially absolute, that even if he were a tyrant, you can't do anything about it. You can't depose the king or anything like that, which makes the ending of Macbeth much more interesting, because there they are, apparently rightfully deposing a tyrannical king. And so there's always that element too, right? Shakespeare is both assuaging the personalities of the leaders and the rulers that he's writing for, but he's also subtly critiquing or criticizing different aspects of them. And so, it's great fun to read and think about in that light.
Yeah, for sure. How about language? I don't know a lot about this, but I know that language was really changing around Shakespeare's time. So it's almost like we will never have another Shakespeare, because we went from Old English to more modern English. And then there's French in there, because I don't know that there's like court going on and things changing with the language as well. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So, that's a great topic to go on. It's just Shakespeare and what he did for the English language.
Right.
English has a really fun history when you look back on it, right? So the British Isle, the Romans went onto the British Isle at varying times with Julius Caesar and then Emperor Claudius. So maybe about 50-ish BC, and then I want to say about 40-ish AD, right? At these different respective times. So the Romans had some settlements there, introducing, of course, the Latin language. Also on the island are the Britons, or the Celts and the Picts and these various other groups. After the Roman occupation, the Romans essentially all left, but yet they kind of left their remnants behind. Mm-hmm. I believe one of the groups on the island, I think it was the Britons, were tired of being oppressed by the Picts and the Celts, and so they invited the Angles and the Saxons to come over to rid them of the oppression of these other groups. So the Angles and the Saxons come over, they say, hey, this is a pretty nice island. Maybe we should stay here. And essentially they set up shop on the British Isle and take over. A number of years later, hundreds of years later, 1044, William of Normandy, right? So a French lord comes over. He lands on England. He essentially conquers that section and establishes a new kingdom there. So he's bringing the French language over. And so you have all these languages mixing together. You have Germanic dialects, you have Roman Latin, now you have French mixing together, creating this new thing, this old English, which of course continues to develop. And then Shakespeare himself, we were going over this the other day, that the average person, I believe, has about 20,000 to 35,000 words as a working vocabulary. Words they could understand, even if they're not using them every day. Mm-hmm. I think they've estimated that Shakespeare is around 50 to 60,000, just working in vocabulary. And part of that's because he's inventing words. He's creating new words. So many of our phrases come from that, right? The envy the green-eyed monster and that sort of idea. So it's also fun to read through Shakespeare and see these different expressions and then realize like, oh, he actually invented that. That's the first place it ever appears. Yeah, so could there be another Shakespeare? I mean, possibly.
You think? Possibly. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think so. There will never be another.
Shakespeare. Yeah, very unlikely, but possible.
Yeah.
But then there's, of course, there's the whole discussion of whether or not Shakespeare was actually one person who wrote all these plays. But...
Right. That's fascinating too. That's another podcast.
Yeah.
I was just looking at words invented by Shakespeare. So you've got the green-eyed monster. I know, I think piety was one that that's not on this list, but I heard that. Bandit, critic, elbow as a verb, like elbow somebody out of the way. Lackluster. I don't know. Any other ones that you remember?
Not off the top of my head. I've looked up lists before, but yeah, there's a lot.
There's a lot. There's some good ones in there. I love it. Great. Well, anything else that you want to share with us? Well, actually, I do have another question, because you were talking about how you don't have necessarily any, well, obviously you don't have any direction you go in asking your students to go with their discussion, specific direction. But I know that you read alongside your students as you go, and you do that every year, which I appreciate so much. So when you go in for a class and you're going to go over a section, how do you do that? Do you just start by asking what they thought about a section? How do you go about teaching that class and getting them to discuss?
Yeah. Yeah. So some of it kind of depends on the day and what the objectives are.
Yeah.
But kind of a usual game plan will be, we'll read a section. So if it's something like Shakespeare, I might assign different parts for those to read. We'll read through it. I'll ask them some kind of content or understanding type questions to make sure they're kind of following along on what's happening. Right, Shakespeare's language can be difficult. I'm not concerned if they understand every little word in the scene, you know, the main idea of the scene, the main action of the scene, main developments. So we'll start there. And then I'll start to usually direct their attention to maybe a specific portion or key elements of the reading or key idea that's being brought out. Maybe give a short mini lecture, you know, thinking maybe 2 minutes, maybe up to 10 if I'm really feeling verbose. And then trying to encourage them to spin that idea out some more. So, I mean, the example that's coming to mind is actually from Oedipus Rex, the other play we considered discussing, where Oedipus essentially commits these great crimes, but they were foretold before his birth, essentially prophesied by Apollo. Everybody involved is trying to avoid them, but yet he's not able to. And so that immediately starts bringing out these questions of fate and predestination and ordination. And if things are ordained beforehand, can you avoid them? If you can't avoid them, then are you really responsible? And so there's these two opposing viewpoints in the Greek mind, right? There's fate and order and kind of fatalism, where, yeah, you have no genuine choice. You're not really guilty for it. You just get the fate that's assigned to you. But then their other alternative is just random chance, right? There is no order. There is no structure. You have no guarantee of the future. It's all just chance. So just roll with it. And so, yeah, I mean, that I think that readily can connect with students and perhaps bigger questions that they might find themselves asking when it comes to the nature of God. And mm-hmm. Well, if God knows the future, then do we make decisions? And if God is marking out those for salvation, well, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for others? And I think that can quickly connect to students.
Yeah.
And cause us to go back to scripture and to think about things in light of God's truth.
So good. Yeah, that's great. One of the many things we appreciate about you, Austin. So anything else you want to share about Macbeth or your classroom or Shakespeare or encouragement for people to get in it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd say just go ahead and dive in. There's an intimidation factor to starting something that's over your head. And I just want to encourage you, understanding is overrated. I understand maybe 10% or less of what I read the first time, if it's a particularly complex book. But that's okay, right? Because the next time you have that 10% or that 5% or that 2%, and the next time you revisit it, you're that much more equipped and able to deal with some of the things. And it's really exciting to go back to a work again and again and to see things you didn't see the first time and see how things connect. Because you're not worried about trying to remember the characters' names or the main plot of the story. And you can start to focus on some more of those details. And it really starts to open up, I think, for me only when I've revisited it, you know, maybe five times or more or something like that. So, I mean, it takes work. It's difficult, but it's worth it. And you shouldn't feel bad if it's hard your first time.
Yeah, that's good. That's encouraging and helpful. What about our students? What if we went over the same thing 5 times? Too bad there's not enough time, right?
Right. Yeah. that's what you have the rest of your life for.
That's right? Exactly right.
It's not that maybe you'll go through the entire corpus, but that you'll have a few favorites or trusted friends that you can return to again and again in your life, because there's wisdom there that you can't exhaust in you know, a few classes in high school.
Right? Yep. Yeah, that's true. But can get the spark going anyways. Yeah. So yeah, I love that. Thanks so much, Austin.
Yeah,
okay, so we always end our podcasts with a recommendation. You've given a good one about how to get into Shakespeare, but is there another one besides that?
Yes. So I've given Macbeth, Henry V. Yes. I guess I'll close with this, is that I think my first introduction to Shakespeare was probably in high school British literature class, where we were going through Hamlet, and I absolutely hated it. I mean, of course, I was very, very cynical and very critical of reading anything old and anything that wasn't modern. I loved reading, but I just didn't like the books that I was assigned at school. Mm-hmm. But Hamlet has become, you know, if not my favorite, second favorite. You know, Macbeth is up there too, but mm-hmm. Shakespeare play. And so I'd highly recommend Hamlet because in some ways it's the most modern of his plays. Kind of this transition between an older age of the supernatural and kind of this transition to a new scientific age. But then all the questions of self-doubt and action, and Hamlet's sometimes been called the man who can't make up his mind. And so he is my brother in that regard.
Oh man, that is a good one. I have to say the Patrick Stewart version of the movie is a very good one. That one I do know.
I don't know if I've seen Patrick Stewart's version of Hamlet.
Okay. It's good.
Okay. I'll have to check it out. Thanks for the recommendation.
Anytime. Yeah, I guess that's mine. Well, thanks so much for meeting with us today. Maybe next time we can go through Oedipus Rex or something else you're doing, but really appreciate you having you here today, Austin.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's great. Always love to talk more about these great books.
Awesome. Great. We'll do it again then. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.